It's been 25 years since the movie Scream was released and became an instant hit with critics and audiences around the world. Wes Craven and Kevin Williamson's knowing slasher spawned three sequels and set a young, hip and scary trend that immediately changed the landscape of cinema. Now with a new installment of the record-breaking saga on the way in 2022, this podcast will celebrate the original release and what came next, maybe with a few twists and turns along the way. I'm Alex James and this is the Woodsboro Podcast. Before we kick off episode one, a bit about me. I'm a broadcaster from Manchester in the United Kingdom and a huge fan of everything Scream. Now, despite having a December 96 release in North America, in the UK, we had to wait till May 1997 to see Scream in cinemas over here. All these years later, I'm still fascinated by the lasting impact of the film and the influence it had on pop culture. I even wrote a university essay all about it at one point. So let's begin, and where better to start than with the man whose job it was to find and create our beloved Woodsboro back in the mid-90s. Eric Klosterman had been the location manager on films including Ghost and Indecent Proposal, and had already worked with Wes Craven on his 95 Eddie Murphy movie, Vampire in Brooklyn. And that's pretty much where Eric's story begins.
I was doing a bunch of things at Paramount in those days, and Vampire in Brooklyn was a Paramount project, so I got hired to do that. I hadn't worked with them before, Wes and his team. When Scream came up, they called me, and I was available, and so they sent me the script, and then they sent me off to find the world, you know, and the main brief was that it was, you know, a small town where we could film at the high school and, you know, have these houses and that would lend themselves to the action. And so I kind of drove from L.A. all the way up the coast to San Francisco and beyond, up to Santa Rosa. Then before I had taken the trip, I started, you know, conversations to try to find a high school, because that was a main component. I mean, it was about a week's worth of work, but since it was an independent, you know, film, it wasn't going to be, we didn't have stages or anything to do interiors on. So everything was going to be practical. The principal from Santa Rosa, you know, was open to the idea, and the time frame, which was in the early spring. I think I started scouting at the beginning of the year. And so, you know, then I, you know, take all the pictures, I come back and we talk about it and decided that Santa Rosa had what we needed. And so then I went back and started looking for more, you know, specific locations and found a lot of the stuff. And then, you know, Wes would come up and we'd start it, you know, scouting and picking locations.
So those locations, when you read kind of the fan perspective, sure, they're almost characters within themselves, aren't they? So how did you begin? Let's start at the very beginning, those first 10 minutes and that house.
I went up to Santa Rosa and was assisted by the lady who was working as the film commissioner at that time. She was a daughter-in-law of Charles Schultz and pretty well connected around the valley there. We basically got in a car and drove, you know, looking at along different roads and different places, trying to see if I could find something that looked interesting to me that would fit the criteria of what the script called for. It didn't really call for that house. It was not quite as specific. And it didn't really call for a house with all kinds of open windows and glass everywhere. But we were driving down the road and I remember there was this old farmhouse right at the highway. It was a two-lane road. It wasn't a highway. She said, "Oh, that they used that house in Cujo." And the company's kind of slowed down. And I said, "Well, it wasn't really right. It was more of a farmhousey kind of a place that didn't really fit." As we went by, there was a driveway going right past it. And down, there was a vineyard basically in the front, and it sloped down a hill. And I could see a house in the background and a big tree in front of it. And I said, that's interesting. Whose house is that? I guess she knew the people and the Wolfs. So we made arrangements to go and look, and I took pictures, and they turned out to be amenable to the idea, and and Wes loved it. And
when you go into a house like that and you see a property like that, you can picture it straight away.
Not always. I mean, you're looking. Yeah, you kind of go through it in your mind of, you know, what's on the page and what it's going to take and where the angles are. You know, if there's room to put a camera, if you have, you know, room to play the scenes, if it's a house, you know, and it requires going from room to room, if there's, you know, physically, you know, on a stage, you build a set and you can take a wall out and you can camera there, but on a house, you really can't. So you've got to, you know, it has to lend itself. It can't be just a bunch of little small rooms, you know, it's got to flow, which that house did.
And the people who owned it had no idea.
They were intrigued by the idea. It took a little convincing. You know, obviously, anyway, I had to make a deal on how much to pay them. And, you know, and we put them up for, well, it was a week of shooting, but, you know, then it was at least, I can't remember now if we used their furniture or if we totally redressed the house. Typically, you would take all their furniture out and put in, you know, your own. But the thing was that on the day when we got there to shoot, it started raining. Mark had devised this big crane with a big light.
Just popping up to say Mark is Mark Irwin, and he's the director of photography on Scream.
Well, they brought a crane in and put this big light box up in the front of the house so that to light the exterior. For me, it turned out to be expensive because unbeknownst to me, this house was sitting in the woods, you know, with essentially you couldn't see anybody, any neighbors. And we had made a deal with the people in the front at the other house to park equipment. So they were cool.
Yeah,
and we were parked across the street from the house for the rest of our equipment and shuttling people and this and that. But after the first night of with this big light in the sky above the house, I got calls at the office from two irate neighbors who I didn't even know, you know, were neighbors. But apparently there was a lady who lived through the woods, I don't know, half a mile away, and because they also lived, you know, in the middle of the woods, they didn't have any, you know, curtains or on their windows. And so this light kept them awake, and she was all upset, and her kids couldn't sleep. And I was very apologetic and sorry, I didn't realize it. And I said, we'll put you up in a hotel, you know, or we'll go over there with blackout curtains, or we'll do, you know, whatever it would take, you know, to make her happy. And so we ended up putting her family up in a hotel for the week, the rest of the week. You know, and that worked out okay. Now the other gentleman who was in the other direction just didn't want anything. He just wanted to complain. And so he did. You know, he wouldn't accept any kind of remuneration. He didn't want to admit that he was, you know, acceding to it. So, you know, that happens. But it was pretty nice. So at the end of the whole thing, the lady whose house we put up turned out that her family owned a winery. And so she sent me a case of her wine, which was the most expensive case of wine I ever got.
Was it good? Can you remember?
You know, it was good. And oddly enough, at some point during the shoot, my wife and a friend of hers came up to visit. And we went on a weekend to go do some wine tasting, as you would do up in that area. And we went to their little winery tasting room, and it wasn't as good as the case that I got. So that was that house. Sydney's house, it was an interesting, I can't remember why it was not really exactly what I was thinking of. It had a look to it. It was much more modern, you know. It was a much newer house. But then after we picked the first one, it kind of, you know, kind of fit. And it was down a driveway off of a road that went up over the hill from Santa Rosa. And we had to build a parking area to be able to get equipment close. There's a lot across the street. But that one we shot pretty much as is. It wasn't that much. I can't remember how many days of shooting. It wasn't as many as the first house.
And were they all in close proximity with each other? What kind of distance are they in?
I mean, Rose McGowan's house was in town, was in Santa Rosa. But anyway, that house was, you know, was more of a in town, you know, in a neighborhood, kind of a on a street of houses kind of a place. It was a little bit different. And but again, had sort of the same kind of Victorian semi. Yeah, you want to have everything be of a piece and feel like it's in the same universe. But the other two houses were, 15 minutes, half an hour out of town. The interesting thing about the house in town was that in talking to the people, we were looking through the house, and in I think one of the bedrooms of the house upstairs, I found this mask. And they had been doing all kinds of research and prototypes and things for the mask, for the screen mask. And I said, what do you think of this? And he said, that's really interesting. Might we borrow that? And so anyway, they ended up, you know, finding the company and getting the okay to use it as the mask.
So that story is one of the stories that's kind of urban myth, but it is the truth. You just found it in one of the rooms.
Yeah, I mean, that's my memory of it. I don't know what other people have said, but it was when we were scouting there, and it wasn't. It was a you know, commercially made mask. It wasn't.
Yeah.
You know, so they had to contact the manufacturer to make sure that it was okay to use it. But then the last house where the big party is, that took a lot more fine, you know, looking. We scoured the area, and I ended up through a realtor finding a place that was vacant. This couple had built the house, and within 6 months after finishing it, both the husband and wife had passed away. So the family still had the house, and they were trying to figure out what to do with it. And I think it was on the market. And anyway, I saw it, and it had a lot of, you know, grounds around it. It had, you know, the drive up, and, you know, it was secluded, you know, it had a lot of the elements of what we were looking for. And it was the fact that it was, wasn't occupied was ideal, because we had quite a few days of shooting there for that whole sequence.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, in driving around the countryside, we kept finding more like farmhouses with barns and, you know, that kind of thing, and which Wes didn't really want the look. He wanted it more of the sort of rural suburban kind of look of the rest of the places, you know. This house fit that, but it didn't have any outbuildings. But because it was sitting up on this hill, and there was nowhere to put equipment without it being in the shot, because we were shooting all the way, you know, 360 degrees, we ended up building the facade of a barn up on the side to put all the equipment behind the working trucks. And then we had a base camp at the bottom of the hill in an empty field. And unfortunately, there again, it started to rain. We had to move our catering and makeup and hair and all the rest of the support stuff across the road to the high school, which they let us use it because we were shooting at night.
At the start of our chat, Eric did refer to his conversations that he had with the local school board when finding a high school location for Scream. Those failed conversations led to the now famous end credit on the Scream role that everybody just loves chatting about. No thanks whatsoever to the Santa Rosa City School District Governing Board. So how did all that go down?
It was a time, I guess, of much like today, a lot of paranoia. And, I had my initial conversation with the principal of the high school and laid out generally what we wanted to do, but we didn't initially have a schedule. You know, I didn't know exactly which days or how it was going to work. And then as we got closer and we started to firm up the schedule, I went back to him and said, oh, these are the days we want, and this is what we want to do. And, because we were going to shoot in the principal's office, you know, had the scene in the bathroom and, in the lockers and the hallways. I forget when we started hearing these rumblings, but it came out, I guess, somehow in the press, you know, that here was Wes Craven Antichrist doing a horror movie in our high school, and we can't really have that, you know, it's crazy. So the principal, you know, so then it to get the final approval, they said it had to go to the school board, and then the school board decided to have a hearing about it, which was held in the high school auditorium, and then, you know, 800 people showed up with ready to comment. And we were all prepped to, you know, lay out our case and say, look, you know, we're just making a movie, you know, it's not right. You shouldn't be, you know, stifling free speech, et cetera. You know, we'd been told, you know, led to believe that it wouldn't be that much of a disruption. Everybody could, you know, we could work it out in the schedule. A lot of people were, you know, objecting to the content of the film, and which we thought was, you know, the wrong thing to do. And so Kevin Williamson and Wes and Stuart Besser, the producer, you know, were all ready to argue their case. And then before the evening happened, they got word from Disney. I guess it was a Miramax, but Disney was behind the financing, saying, don't fight it. Don't say anything. I was walked out to the lobby, and I saw the principal while, you know, people were come up and they'd give their spiel, and, you know, they get this long public comment. And the principal said to me, you know, I'm really sorry, but I can't back this anymore. I'm just too many headwinds. And so, you know, they turned us down. So then we had to try and find another location. We went on a weekend, I believe it was, to look at, in Petaluma, there was a former school that was being used as an administrative building, and that it would look like a school, and it had enough of the elements that we thought it would work. And immediately after, or even while we were scouting it, somebody had heard about it, and some preacher got up on a Sunday and made a sermon about how, you know, awful, you know, we were, and how could we allow this in the town where, of course, it was close to the time when the Polyclass case happened.
In case you didn't know, the Polyclass case is the disappearance and ultimate murder of 12-year-old Polyclass, who was abducted and killed in Petaluma, where Eric had extended their location search.
So they were pretty, you know, sensitive, I guess, to that kind of a thing. And so that avenue didn't work. And we were getting, you know, I don't know if we'd already started shooting or we were, you know, but I basically I brought another location manager up to do some scouting, you know, and try to find another place. And and he came across in Sonoma, in the city of Sonoma, there was a school that had been turned in a nice two-story building, school building, and it had been, was used now as a community center. It was no longer a school. It was a community center where they had, you know, programs, and they did, you know, we ended up making a deal with those people to use them for 3 days. And then we ended up building, you know, in an old lumberyard warehouse stage, the bathroom and the principal's office in the hallway, and a bit of, you know, basically the principal's office as a set.
Those frustrations, though, for you guys at that point, you can't even begin to imagine the stress. And was there any element of, so many people would have been part of that meeting at the school, was there any ill will that then bled over into the rest of the production when you guys
really?
Were in town?
We shot the town, you know, the center of town where the kids would meet up, was in Healdsburg. It's another little town north of Santa Rosa, and they were, you know, quite accommodating. We took an empty storefront there and turned it into the police station. By and large, you know, once we got going, people we didn't really have much opposition. It was mainly the school. And my one of my challenges early on when I was out scouting was that they named the company that, you know, that typically you'll form a company to do each production, and this one was called Frightmare Inc. So people were sometimes a little leery of the fact that was what I was, you know, that I, where, who I represented, you know. And so, you know, as is typical in places where they don't have a lot of film, and people are usually generally excited by the prospect.
I mean, it's different looking back at it now, but the idea of filming however long it was with Drew Barrymore in the middle of nowhere and nobody gets, and people like Courtney Cox and Neve Campbell, who big TV stars, nobody gets a sense that this is happening in their community.
Well, you don't publicize it. You don't say, well, here's where we're shooting today, you know, or anything.
You imagine kind of like how word would spread so quickly these days that
you'd be on the defense. Courtney Cox and David Arquette got into trouble, I think, one night when they went out drinking. But I mean, we did have all that kerfuffle about the high school, and that certainly got us more than the normal, you know, publicity for a show in production with really not any, you know, real big stars. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, showing up with big stars with their entourages.
Yeah, sure.
You know, as you know, if Jennifer Aniston were going out today, you know, it's a lot different than back then.
So when you take the time to kind of reflect on your role in it, how does that make you feel? Can you contextualize it now 25 years later? And
you know, I'm proud of the work that we did. The way, as you mentioned at the beginning, you know, the locations are characters in the film, and that's kind of the way we, you know, try to approach it. You find places that aid in the telling of the story and that enhance it. It was very stressful, but I enjoyed it. You know, I really liked the people. I loved working with Wes. And you know, his team, Marianne and Stuart and Dixie Kapp and Nick Mastandrea, the first AD. I don't interact with the cast all that much, but I went on to start to do another film with Wes, but I wasn't available when they were doing the sequels, and I kind of fell out of sequence with him. We're always trying to stay working, and you know, directors are usually editing and lining up their next project in the time, you know, so that it's hard to stay in sync with them. Wes lived not too far from me, up in the Hollywood Hills at the time, and I just remember going over to his house and sitting around all his books and a big living room, and you know, I really enjoyed, felt like he was a friend, you know, and But we worked on one other film that didn't get made at the time. This was about 2001, maybe. I think it was called Cursed. It eventually got made, but at the first go around, the plug got pulled, and I ended up coming down with rheumatoid arthritis at that point and had to leave the project about a week before they shut down completely. But
so before you left Cursed, did you get a sense that it wasn't going well and that there was a lot of...
We were having trouble finding locations, and they were, you know, I don't forget what the financing or what it was, or the acting, getting the actors they wanted at the time, you know, it just didn't come together. Yeah, I can't remember now why exactly it fell apart.
What's the overriding memories of the man he was and the filmmaker that he was?
Very, you know, he was a gentleman and a scholar, and you know, I found him to be very reasonable, you know, pretty precise, you know, in what he wanted, and he was, you know, obviously he could get as annoyed and frustrated as any director can on a movie, but he was always didn't get out of, you know, let himself get out of hand with it. I just remember, you know, it felt like a, you know, kind of a, you know, real family of people. It was especially, you know, when you do a second film with a group, you know, you get that feeling. And I've been lucky enough to work with a couple of directors a few times, you know, a couple of times. And if you enjoy working with them, then you do sign up to do it again with him.
What do you personally attribute the success of it then? On its initial release to, and the kind of long lasting impact that it's had?
I don't know. I mean, the idea of parody and and wit, conjoined with this horror movie, I think it was the ripe, the time was, ripe for that kind of treatment of, before you got into the Saw and all of those gruesome things with no kind of, this at least, was, self-aware and, playing, having, having fun with the whole idea. And that, I think, made it much more enjoyable, that because you were in on the joke and you knew that it was, people were dying, but it was, it was light, it was, and that was the because everybody was joking about it, and it wasn't exactly campy, it was just kind of ironic and I guess that fit the times.
Do you think because as a crew were filming in actual houses on actual locations, from your experience and your expertise, does that heighten the scariness of it, and does that environment make such a difference?
Shooting on location does give you it presents challenges, but it forces you to use those elements in order to enhance the story and not be a drawback. And if you do it right, if you use what's there and pick up the details and emphasize them in a way that lends to the character. I don't know.
And do you ever, when you're with this film or any other project that you've worked on, when it's been real places and real families in real houses, do you ever go, just in case this is a massive success, be warned, you might have people turning up on your doorstep for as long as you live here?
No, I can't say that I have ever warned people, because you never think that something is going to be necessarily a massive hit. Certainly we never imagined that our little Frightmare Inc. project. I don't know, I'm not really well versed in all of this fan stuff and people following the real locations and trying to find them and all that. So I don't know what the impact has been.
I think there was a lot of obsession around Casey's house for a long time. People being able to try and find that because it was so remote and so private.
Right. Did people find it?
It's insane. I mean, you can lose hours on the internet with people who've devoted big sections of their lives. I mean, nowadays, obviously, with Google Earth and being able to find places, it's a lot easier. But I think probably mid 2000s, at that point, when I first sort of explored this corner of the internet, you had people who'd managed to find the real estate listings for some of them after they'd been sold, maybe 10 years after. After the film, and any sort of nugget like that was considered the golden ticket for fandom. But that's kind of, that's the interesting side for me, is that reading this information and seeing this information and being able to consume that is great. And that's why the internet's a wonderful thing. But from your perspective, and this is why I'm so honored that you've agreed to do this today, is the fact that that's your work, and sometimes when I do speak to people involved in really major productions, whether it's music or film or television, whether you ever have those moments where you kind of go, God, that every day I still play a part in a certain section of society's life.
I can't say that that I think in those terms, frankly. I certainly have had moments where I see a film and I'm happy to recognize something that doesn't necessarily stand out, but that really works in a film that I've done. You have those moments of when I did a film called Love Field. We shot in North Carolina and in Richmond, Virginia. It was all about Michelle Pfeiffer. I don't know if you're familiar with the film, but Michelle Pfeiffer, it's right after Kennedy gets shot, she decides to go to Washington, D.C. to go to the funeral. I remember, well, a lot of moments, but we were doing a motorcade scene, and it was in Richmond. There was this big, long boulevard. I don't know how many blocks we had blocked off, but I was just remember standing in the middle of the street, and, you know, traffic is hell, we're getting ready to go. And I'm saying, well, I just, you know, I did this. I made it all happen, you know? It did. And, you know, it is nice to feel like you had some part in it. Certainly the times when you have done a lot of extensive scouting and found, you know, really found a nugget that, as in the case of Scream, I think, you know, you found the things that were not exactly what was expected, but ended up, you know, being the right thing. Mm-hmm. And of course the director, you know, makes the choices, and he had, you know, we gave them a lot of choices for all these houses. You know, it's nice when you can put something in front of them that is attuned to what they're looking for. And maybe say, oh, that's another way to look at it. Yeah, let's do that.
There's the section in Sydney's house where obviously it has this kind of innocent level where she gets off the school bus and then goes into the house and the beautiful sunset over the valley.
Right.
And then everything turns more sinister as darkness comes in, and kind of, you know, that house plays a part in that, doesn't it?
Right. It gives you that, it looks like, oh, nothing could ever go wrong. And then as you know, happened in Casey's house as well, you know, this looks like a regular, you know, very bright and open, even, I mean, not bright because it was at night when you saw it, but still, yeah. Yeah, well, that's the art of movie making, I guess.
Eric Klosterman retired as a location manager several years ago and now works for the California Film Commission. And a big, big thank you to Eric for sharing such a special story here on the podcast. And finally, we get to know some of the truths behind some of the stories that have lived on in Scream folklore for many, many years. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Woodsboro Podcast. Please rate and subscribe so you don't miss future episodes. And if you'd like to join the conversation, then you can find more on social media at the Woodsboro Pod. And you can find me on social media too at This Is Alex James.